Hello, everybody. Welcome to another edition of Brain Trust, Conversations in Clinical Psychopharmacology. I'm Joe Goldberg, a clinical professor of psychiatry at the Icahn School of Medicine in Mount Sinai in New York, here to welcome you to another opportunity to have a conversation with one of our esteemed colleagues in clinical psychopharmacology on, well, we talk about various topics that hopefully are of burning interest to you as practitioners, things you may or may not recognize as, gee, that's an important thing. I never thought about that. How do I go about that? And we kind of try to give curbside informal discussions and dialogues to prompt and stimulate thinking and sort of keep everyone on their toes. So today will be no exception to our direction in that area. It's a real pleasure to be joined today by a longtime friend and colleague of mine, Dr. Anita Clayton. Let me introduce her. Dr. Clayton, if you don't know, is a world expert in clinical psychopharmacology with respect in particular to women's mental health and issues around sexual dysfunction. She is the Wolford am I saying this right? Spradlin Professor, and until very recently, Chair of Psychiatry and Neurobehavioral Sciences at the University of Virginia. Dr. Clayton also is the current president of the American Society of Clinical Psychopharmacology, a terrific organization that I encourage everyone to become aware of and involved with. It's taken on some very important initiatives of late in clinical psychopharmacology on topics related to deprescribing, polypharmacy. Dr. Clayton's helping co-chair a task force on women's reproductive psychiatry, expert consensus. So good things we hope to see coming further and further from ASCP. Anita's published very widely on the topic of sexual dysfunction, its measurement, its phenomenology, its disentanglement from disease state symptoms as opposed to medication side effects. So with that background, Anita, welcome to Brain Trust.
Thanks, Joe. Glad to be here.
A pleasure.
I'm always glad when people are going to talk about this topic.
It's an important one, isn't it?
It is.
Not just because it's your area, but why is this an important and underappreciated topic in psychopharmacology?
I would say basically because only 1% or so of people are asexual. So that means 99% of us care about it. We just don't always talk about it. And there's a stigma with talking about it, much like psychiatric conditions. So I think people want to know about it and they want to know what they maybe can do about something. They may not have even known it was a problem per se, that anything could be done about. And so I think it really can enhance people's quality of life for us to be thinking about these issues.
I wonder how many of our viewers and listeners proactively ask patients about their sex lives, and in particular, how they may change in relation to an episode of depression or anxiety or medicine. When you teach, when you consult and supervise, how do you encourage clinicians to bring that into an interview process?
So the easiest way to do it is to just make it part of your assessment when you start talking about various lifestyle things, like do you eat healthy? Do you exercise? Do you have sex? Are you interested in it? And then has there been a change in these things? And do you see anything as a problem? Often patients are thinking this. They just are hesitant to bring it up. In fact, there was a survey done a number of years ago that basically said about 3/4 of all patients said they didn't bring up the topic of sex because they were afraid it would bother their provider. And we're not taught in medical school about talking to patients about sexual functioning or really about the diagnoses we have in the DSM. And so I think we have to sort of catch up to that and help our patients. And in particular, I would say for perimenopausal women, this has been a topic that has just not been talked about, but that is starting to really explode right now. So your patients may come in and talk to you about this, or they may come in and say something and you should follow up and asking about their sexual functioning too.
Wow. Tell us more about how and why it's exploding now.
Probably because there's a lot of women like me who are going through, I'm already through the menopause, but where we notice things about our body that's changing. And we want to not necessarily have all of those things happen. And some of them are inconvenient, and like urinary incontinence or things like that that happen. But genitourinary syndrome of menopause, for example, really contributes to vaginal dryness, diminished desire, diminished orgasmic function, either frequency or intensity or duration. And women do notice this. So they want to know, and they should know.
So mental health clinicians, psychiatrists, and our other colleagues who prescribe and treat mental health conditions often are asking their questions in the context of a chief complaint that may coalesce around depression, anxiety, cognitive functioning, substance use. Any particular thoughts about the couching of sexuality in that regard? D different than the way a primary care clinician might do that. I, for instance, often link it with anhedonia. Or when I'm asking my questions about the ability to derive and experience pleasure from basic things like music, food, sex is always the third thing. Maybe it should be the second or the first. Is that a fair way to get at it in our unique population, or how would you sort of think of that context?
Absolutely. I think we should be asking about that as part of our diagnostic exam, right? And then we should be following that across time in terms of seeing the response. We know that anhedonia is less likely to respond to our standard antidepressants, and then standard antidepressants can further contribute to sexual dysfunction, especially the SSRIs. And so when we're thinking about what we're going to then prescribe for someone, I usually ask about their preferences. Like, what kinds of adverse effects would you want to avoid? And I always hear, I don't want to gain weight and I don't want to have sexual dysfunction. I mean, people sort of know that I talk about it, but still, those are what people are saying that they don't want to have. And there's surveys that have shown this as well. And so I think it's up to us to bring it forward and ask them. If somebody doesn't want to talk about sex, they'll just say, I don't need to talk about that. I'm not having sex, or I'm divorced, or I'm a widow, or whatever they say. It doesn't necessarily mean that those people aren't having sex, but maybe they aren't, or not as frequently as they used to.
But a light bulb should go off over the clinician's head if they're picking up information about lack of interest in
For
sex
sure. I mean,
or
that's on the
weight.
HAM-D,
Yeah.
right? Asking about interest, sexual desire, libido, whatever you want to call it. And a problem with your sexual desire, loss of it, or complete absence of it is the primary sexual dysfunction in women in this country. And it's about 10% of all women. However, about 40% of that 10%, it's probably related to depressive symptoms. So we really should be on top of it. And when we're talking to patients about depression and anxiety, frequently men are more likely to have performance anxiety related to sexual activity, and then that can contribute to other things. So that is a question often to ask men about what's ha happening in terms of their sexual functioning. And men know. I also check testosterone levels in men in particular. And especially if there's a depression that is not responding to treatment or is no longer responding to treatment, and they've aged, and so that's one of the things I check is testosterone levels.
Is andropause a real thing?
Well, it depends on what you mean by that, because it's so much more gradual. But yes, of course, if you look at the range of testosterone levels that are part of the lab studies, what you can find is that as men get older, and you don't have to be very old to start to see a decline in testosterone levels. So the truth really is that by age 45, we really start to see men experiencing sexual dysfunction. And some of that is related to diminished levels of testosterone, but it's not like the levels go up and down across the cycle, a cycle, like in women. And it's also that it's a very gradual process. Also, other medical issues are coming on men at about 45, so we tend to see weight gain, potentially diabetes, sleep apnea, all these kind of things. If your sleep is disturbed, it can also really impact on your sexual functioning. So it's important for us to be considering that in the whole context of the individual.
This becomes a really useful diagnostic assay in some ways to not just check the box in my review of systems about sexual functioning, but if I'm picking up a signal about interest in sex and or the logistics, I guess, and mechanics of the sexual response, that may lead me down a whole particular pathway of I better be sure I've screened for depression. I better be sure I've screened for what else? Substance use disorders.
Oh, sure.
Hypothyroid. I mean,
Potentially, and also hormonal changes. I do think about it, and like I said, if somebody does have symptoms of depression in particular that are not responding to treatment, they're a man, they're over 50 for sure, I'll probably check a testosterone level. I have two male patients that recently I found that to be the case. And interestingly, their primary care provider, I sent them to their primary care provider and said, you know, they can start you on this because urology wasn't going to see him for 4 months or something. And she said, no, she wouldn't do it. So I said, well, I will. So I didn't give him massive doses either. And when he did see the urologist doubled the dose I'd been giving him. So, you know, we do need to think about it, and we need to work in conjunction with other types of physicians too.
How strong is the connect or juxtaposition between interest and logistics? So if someone's both in men and women, if I'm complaining of issues around satisfaction or orgasmic delay, as opposed to interest, is that diagnostically helpful? My interest is there, but the mechanics, as opposed to both are down.
Yeah, so we should really be looking then for more biological problems if you see these functional impairments. One of the other things, though, that is really common, and I ask about it sort of later in the in as after bringing up some things about sexual functioning, is porn. Because people don't like to admit that they look at porn, but people masturbate, and now you have porn that's on your phone or on your computer or your whatever. The problem with that is that it has an algorithm to escalate the porn to more and more violent, potentially deviant, other kinds of things.
AI strikes again?
AI strikes again.
I did not know that. Continue.
Yeah, and so people are not, you know, suddenly they're into threesomes, or they're into more dress up or fantasy. Well, it's beyond fantasy. It's usually clearly things that are fairly aggressive in terms of sexual activity. And the problem is that once that is what you're using to have an orgasm, then when you go back to regular sex with your partner, you may have trouble. And so, and then those individuals may try to get their partners to go along with some of this, and often that's not what their partner wants. I mean, it's not been in the relationship for a long time. I mean, it certainly is possible they would, but it's sort of insidious. That people just don't realize that this is potentially impacting, and it's more on function in terms of that. Desire, we know, is impacted by all kinds of things, and sometimes it's the relationship, it's not what it used to be, or partner technique And when it's just not good, you may not want to have sex that often. But when you really have low sexual desire that's distressing and bothersome to you, very often there are lots of biological factors, and some of those are modifiable. So whether or not we're thinking about it in the context of treating how we treat the depression, which we should be, we also can think about like certain modifiable factors would be things like if they're perimenopausal, should they potentially have estrogen, or should they have testosterone? We give testosterone to women too. The problem is for reproductive age women, it's a bigger issue because they could potentially become pregnant. But even birth control pills can cause sexual dysfunction. And I've had plenty of cases of young women who are on birth control pills who are on an SSRI and they're having sexual dysfunction. So we switched them from the SSRI, which was working well for their depression or anxiety. And we switched them and they're doing okay, but it's not quite the same. And the desire doesn't change at all. So we usually try to get them to switch to some other birth control method, rather than birth control pills, and then it clears up, and we can put them back on the medicine that was really working for them, and they don't have sexual dysfunction. So we really have to think about other medicines too. So a lot of our patients are complex. So birth control pills are one of those things, but we know this, antihypertensives, but interestingly, we don't always know about these things, which are opioids taken chronically, and these are all chronic use, non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs taken chronically
Cause sexual dysfunction.
can contribute to sexual dysfunction. So it's worth, because prostaglandins are involved, especially in terms of genital sexual function. And so we really have to be thinking about these other kinds of medicines contributing, or conditions that are contributing, right? If you have diabetes and it's not well controlled, you're going to have sexual dysfunction. And in fact, the advice related to men who come in and are complaining in about their 40s and are complaining of erectile dysfunction or problems is you need to test them for diabetes right off and not wait. So if you're going to check testosterone, fine, but you need to get a hemoglobin A1C and or a glucose as part of a comprehensive metabolic panel.
The clinician really has to be on their toes thinking about the entirety of the patient medically, psychologically, pharmacologically.
Yeah, and if people drink alcohol, that's, people drink to sort of get loosen
Loosen
up.
up.
Yeah,
Heard that.
for sex and or to approach somebody or whatever it is. But the fact is that usually there's more of that going on than is required, and it then leads to dysfunction, which is, exactly what they were afraid of.
So, hypoactive sexual desire disorder is a thing, or can you speak to
Yes,
that as
so
a thing?
it has been for a long time. It used to be called other things that we're not gonna
That
address.
18th century language.
Sort of, yes. And derogatory language too, right? But as I said, it's about 10% of the population. It's been in all the DSMs up to DSM-5. DSM-5 combined hypoactive sexual desire disorder and sexual arousal disorder into a single diagnosis. And this is at least in part because there were no psychiatrists who could serve on the committee because who were actively involved in caring for patients with and doing research in sexual dysfunction. We couldn't be on that DSM-5 committee if we had earned more than $10,000 in total related to industry of any sort. And so they had all psychologists on there who really don't have a medical model in their training. And so the diagnosis of sexual interest, wait a minute, sexual interest and arousal disorder, SIAD, is in the DSM-5. And we actually studied that too. And about half the people who have HSDD wouldn't meet the criteria because you have to have some of these arousal problems too. And plus, what's going on in your genitals is not what's going on in your brain per se, right? And there is such a thing, I think, as cognitive desire, but I really, and people talk about it, or cognitive arousal is really maybe desire, that's continued. So you have desire, you get involved, and you get more excited, and you want to keep going in this, and that's a sort of additional cognitive process. There are also women who are interested in sex, start to have sex, and then lose interest because they're thinking about, oh gosh, I forgot to turn off the oven, or oh, I need to make sure that I get the kids dressed appropriately because tomorrow's when the school pictures are, or whatever else. So they're starting to think about other things that is distracting them from their sexual activity. On the flip side, there are plenty of young women with hypoactive sexual desire disorder who are perfectly able to get aroused and have an orgasm, but they don't really want to have sex. And so there's nothing sort of driving them to it. And their partners think they're not interested in them anymore, or that they don't love them anymore, or they're cheating on them, all kinds of things, because she's really not interested, even though she's clearly aroused and has an orgasm during sexual activity.
So when does a drug like flibanserin come into the?
Yeah, so that's where flibanserin really would come in.
And for those of our listeners who may not be so familiar with that medicine.
Yes, so flibanserin is also called Addy, is the brand name, and you can get it either in pharmacies or patients can, or in through a website if you just look it up. Addy, AYD,
ADDYI.
ADDYI. Yes, thanks. But flibanserin is a 5-HT1A agonist and a 5-HT2A antagonist. So it's sort of like a combination of buspirone and maybe trazodone,
Can I
and
make my own that way? Or if I should I think about that if I'm
I
a
wouldn't advise
rheumatologist?
that, but you could think about that in the context of a particular patient you're treating for an
Okay.
anxiety disorder, or you needing an augmenting strategy, or things like that, or they're not sleeping. Yes. I mean, we have plenty of people on that combination.
And we'll talk in just a few minutes about antidote strategies, but I guess we'll come to it. There are data with both buspirone and trazodone and maybe other 5-HT2A antagonists as antidote strategies. But so who's a candidate for Addy? It's someone who's
So it used to, the FDA only approved it after a huge fight. And I'll just show you guys this movie, The Pink Pill. Yeah, if you've heard of it, it's about that whole process. And this is, they made up some flyers, and this is a picture of me from my headshots. And they did it for other people who were in this film. But it's on Paramount Plus, and it's worth watching to understand that the FDA doesn't really understand about sexual functioning in terms of the division of urologic, obstetrics, and gynecologic products. And now the CNS group has invited that group in to deal with all the sexual functioning stuff, and they've made a mess of it, really. So they just recently, it got approved in premenopausal women. They made us test them separately as if, these mechanisms have something to do with our hormones, which they don't really, right? Buspirone and trazodone.
So I'm not supposed to prescribe that medicine in postmenopausal women.
You weren't supposed to, but they just recently
Oh, okay, good. Now I can.
approved. Well, of course, we prescribe off-label all the time as psychiatrists, but They did just go with that because the data were already there. There just hadn't been an application for that, and there's no reason to limit it. So they did do that, and just like they just said that, okay, vaginal estrogen does not cause breast cancer. It does not get systemic. Previously, there's a black box warning about it. And I've had colleagues here in gynecology and other places who've been fighting this for 20 years, really.
Wow.
So you can get this for your patients, and it is helpful, especially if in about 50% of patients, much like our other monoamine active drugs. And for some people, it's really, really impressive and so positive for them. And they feel like they have, you know, their youth back and their interest is back like that, and their relationship is better and all kinds of things like that.
Interesting. So before we get to antidote strategies, the ways in which, first do no harm, the ways in which our pharmacologies can impede or impair sexual dysfunction. Everybody thinks about high prolactin as a consequence, but there's other ways our drugs cause mischief and mayhem serotonergically and otherwise. Can you speak to why and how do our medicines disrupt sexual function?
So we need to think about sexual functioning as an excitatory. There's excitatory elements and there's inhibitory elements, right? And the inhibitory elements include serotonin. They also include cannabis, for example, because there are endocannabinoids. And so chronic daily cannabis use can be problematic. And for other reasons as well, but there's also lack of excitation. So if you don't have adequate norepinephrine, dopamine, they're involved in sexual activity, and those are the three of them are all very important in desire. And then things like norepinephrine and dopamine also matter in terms of arousal. We don't see so much of serotonin on that, but we definitely see it doing other things that contribute to orgasmic dysfunction. So, for example, serotonergic drugs sort of overwhelm the system regarding norepinephrine and dopamine because it's the biggest inhibitor, and norepinephrine and dopamine do exert their excitatory elements on serotonin systems, but not to the same degree. The strength of that effect. So if your serotonin is really up and really inhibiting, you're really going to have a problem all the way through because you won't really have the same level of arousal and pleasure.
Is 5-HT2A a particularly problematic target? If you agonize it, do you make sexual dysfunction happen? Or make...
Presumably, yes.
So the hallucinogens are probably not going to be a great aphrodisiac, huh?
Well, not while you're having a mystical experience. So
I can hear some viewers feeling disappointment at that, but go on.
well, yeah, that's like cannabis too. People say they smoke to relax, and then it's really contributing to
Interesting. So
problems.
the mechanisms really matter here. Okay, go
Yeah,
on.
they do. They really do. And that's where prolactin comes in too. If prolactin is elevated, it starts to cause problems with arousal, but it spreads everywhere. So the more elevated prolactin you have, the worse your sexual function usually is. And people who need to be on antipsychotics, you know, they don't have that, like if they have a psychotic disorder, they don't have that many pleasures in life. So it's usually eating, sex, and then drugs.
So speaking of, so when we think about favor the prolactin sparing atypical antipsychotics when you can, but even then, take aripiprazole or brexpiprazole or cyproconazole, pretty prolactin sparing, you can still get sexual dysfunction or markedly less so.
It's less. It is less. And aripiprazole,
Cariprazine.
well, cariprazine hasn't shown it as well, but lumateperone has. We just presented a paper on using the changes in sexual function questionnaire, which I developed and validated in a clinical trial, and their sexual functioning markedly improved.
Is that
So,
because lumateperone is such a potent 5-HT2A antagonist?
well, it is that. Yeah.
And in this in the antidepressant world, so everybody learns in residency, if you want to use sexually sparing antidepressants, you think of bupropion, mirtazapine, another really powerful 5-HT2A blocker. I guess nefazodone, with all the respect to the liver, counts still. And then we've got a few agents like vortioxetine. Can you speak to what's kind and gentle in the sexual realm beyond what I've mentioned?
Well, yes, vortioxetine for sure. And I was also involved in the studies to demonstrate that it was superior both to escitalopram and also so if people were switched or if there was a comparison. So directly with an SSRI, and it was escitalopram. And it has so many. It has what, seven receptor effects or system effects in serotonin, and some of those are positive, and just like some of those are positive for cognition, and some of those are positive for well, th that probably this probably depends on sleep. You want to improve sleep. That's one thing flibanserin does. Is you get a great sleep, and that we had to study this because the FDA made objected and said, oh, this makes people sleepy when they take it at night, and they might wake up and have an accident driving their kids to school. And it was like, seriously? So anyway, there was a comparison done versus a drug like Ambien, because they didn't want it studied in the US versus Ambien, but so it was done in Canada. And actually, people's cognition and driving, there was a driving simulator and all this stuff, improved dramatically with flibanserin. So it wasn't just working on the sexual interest, it was also improving their sleep, which made them cognitively better also. So we and vortioxetine does similar kinds of things.
Interesting.
It improves cognition.
That's 5-HT7.
Huh?
The 5-HT7
Yeah,
receptor.
right.
So
Which we had never even heard of before, right?
right. So your study actually even controlled for baseline pre-randomization sexual
Sexual
complaints that might
dysfunction.
be explainable by the depression, and still showed that after you've accounted for that confounding factor, vortioxetine was still a better choice. In terms of minimizing sexual dysfunction that would otherwise be iatrogenic, say with an SSRI.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
That's an important point.
And it is important to realize that about 70% of people who present with a major depressive episode have, at baseline before treatment, they have sexual dysfunction of some sort. So you want to ask about that. Then when you treat
70%.
them, 70,
Wow.
it's 30 to 80, but the studies really favor the high
A
number.
substantial majority.
Yes.
Why are
And
so
then you got to watch for what you prescribe. So that's why I ask for preferences. Do you want to avoid sexual dysfunction? Do you want to avoid weight gain and stuff? And so some of these drugs have both of those things. And then you have to monitor it afterwards, because otherwise, 70% of people on SSRIs have sexual dysfunction. So it could be different people in those 70%.
Yeah.
But we want to avoid it, in truth, as a result of our medications.
Now I'm going to imagine among our listeners and viewers that the word bupropion is on the minds of a number of people right now. Why are our listeners thinking about bupropion so much, and should they be?
Yeah, they should be. So this is one of the early things that I was involved in, was an advisory board, which I think it was GlaxoSmithKline, back then, related to bupropion. And I was using it, and I had patients who said, "This drug makes me horny," and stuff like that. And I'm like, So we studied it, and we certainly found improvements in sexual functioning with bupropion.
Not just sparing.
Right, improvements.
Okay. Listen carefully, folks. Continue, Anita.
And so, and in fact, what I basically said in the, you could add it though, too. We did those studies too. So you could add it to an SSRI that was
Not.
working that was causing sexual dysfunction. And I basically said to them, look, whether it's the primary drug or it's an add-on drug, you're still getting an additional prescription. So what's the problem here? Let's use bupropion in either of these two ways. And people have gotten that message. And I think it's a good thing. Now, some people don't tolerate bupropion, but way back when we were doing this, we really had only the immediate release. And then when we got the sustained release, it was much easier to manage, and people didn't have some of the same peak effects that were negative. And then the extended release, or the XL, is even more so. And you still get those benefits.
So I know some of the handful of studies that have looked at bupropion as an antidote for antidepressant-induced sexual dysfunction have looked at daily dosing. I know there's at least one study that treated it like a phosphodiesterase inhibitor, where you gave it before it
Just
was.
before.
What's your advice if someone is, if a clinician is contemplating introducing bupropion? Certainly, if someone needs an augmentation for their depression to boot, and if they want to lose weight and stop smoking, you've got a nice runway.
You do.
But if one was thinking, all's good except for the sexual dysfunction, I don't want to take away the drug that's helpful, what do you advise as far as dosing and preparation and so on?
So there were some studies of adding bupropion at 150 milligrams per day, and it wasn't effective. So you really have to get to 300 milligrams a day. I don't know if you just want to blast people with 300 milligrams a day before sex.
No one's done that
I
study.
haven't done that. No, and I haven't recommended, but I do have people who take things PRN, like people take buspirone PRN, and it helps them. Is that placebo? Is that, just their belief that this drug is helping them or whatever? It's benign, so I'm not going to object to that. They don't do it every
But you
day.
favor daily dosing to get to.
I do. I do.
Okay.
Because especially when you're working on desire, so there is a drug out for treatment of hypoactive sexual desire disorder called bremelanotide or Vyleesi. It's an injection, though, so you take it right before 45 minutes before sex, but it lasts about 24, 36 hours, something like that. So for a weekend kind of thing, it could be reasonable. I thought people would really object to the injections when we were doing those studies, but they really didn't. And we were not even using, I mean, you had to draw it up and poke yourself. But some people got their partners to give it to them, which they put into
Introduces
their
another
sex
level of
play,
interaction.
right?
Okay.
And but it causes a lot of nausea. Okay, it causes a lot of nausea, like 40% of the people. So often, if that happens, I would say, okay, give it to yourself on Friday when you're going to bed, and then you can have sex on Saturday and Sunday, and you'll have increased desire. So there are these other options where you can do something as needed and still get a benefit. It acts on the melanocortin system, and which is different. And now we're starting to look at that system for some other things in psychiatry. But this has been approved for
Well,
10, a little less than 10 years.
Wow. So, what's the story with the phosphodiesterase inhibitors to treat iatrogenic sexual dysfunction in women as well as men? What's the story there?
So there were some there was one study done that kind of showed some positive stuff, but not like I would have expected. And part of that was I think they didn't use the right tool to measure the sexual dysfunctions, because I do use it in women. I use lower doses. I use 50 in women, but I give it to men 50 or 100.
We're talking sildenafil as well as
Sildenafil.
tadalafil. Any preference? I guess you get
Well,
long.
I'm just, I have way more familiarity with sildenafil, and so I have used that over the years. And if it's a specifically an arousal problem, that can be quite helpful.
Is that because
It
it helps
doesn't
you?
get in the brain, though. It's
What
not,
is it about expectancy bias? I mean, if the concept
maybe.
here is the vasodilatory effects and the orgasmic quality, will I impact arousal and interest because my expectancy is better? I'm not saying this.
Maybe.
I'm not
Who
saying this is what
cares?
I wanted. Well,
Right?
mechanistically, I mean, because the other question would be, I guess, if somebody finds that, say, if a man finds erectile dysfunction is better, will that translate to improved interest and arousal if I have low
It
interest?
might very well, because look, if he's got erectile dysfunction, he's probably anxious every time he has sex or is thinking about sex and is fearful that he's going to have an erectile problem. And so, yes, if that's improved and it's not an issue, that might very well increase his desire and increase his level of activity.
So we got the bupropion story, the phosphodiesterase inhibitor story. How about buspirone? We were talking about 5-HT1A before, and I know there's this one study out there suggesting it can
The
have that one
Landers
as well. What
study.
do you think of that?
The problem is that those data are poor, but it doesn't really matter to me, because I know it works. A lot of people say buspirone doesn't even work, right? But it does. It got approval for generalized anxiety disorder first. Benzos don't have it, have an approval for that and stuff. So anyway, it's the subsequent clinical use has really shown that it can be a benefit for people, and it could also help enhance their antidepressant treatment in terms of their depression and not just in terms of their sexual functioning, but it can enhance sexual functioning.
Do you think Jeparone, Exua, which got approved a few years ago and just came out here in 2026, like yesterday, actually, do you think that's going to have an appeal in the same vein as buspirone with regards to, say, sparing sexual side effects, but also potentially having a counteracting antidote value?
Because we were, and I've been involved with Jeparone since it was owned. I don't even know when it was, 15, 20 years ago. Organon had it, and then I think somebody else had it. Anyway, some other companies
Hands.
had it, and finally, it's been approved and brought to market. But in the course of those was. We were very concerned about SSRIs and sexual dysfunction. We knew about it. So they were looking at sexual functioning in a lot of their studies, which is probably why some of their studies didn't separate that well in terms of the depression efficacy from another drug or placebo or whatever, because there was so much activity around sex in these clinical trials. And people don't do that anymore, because you don't want to screw up your phase three trials with this. You can get that information potentially later. It definitely, we recently, Tierney Lorenz is the first author on a paper that I'm on, where we looked at Jeparone ER, the studies re that related to sexual functioning. And it really is quite positive in sexual functioning. It's certainly at least as good as placebo, and there's potentially pro-sexual effects. I mean, I'm sure the company can't say that, but I can.
We can talk about it.
So I think that if people sort of get over the idea that it's buspirone and it's not really intended for depression, because I think that if you relate it to buspirone, you're not thinking about major depression, but it is an antidepressant. It works a bit differently than buspirone, and it's very positive in its effects on sexual functioning. It will have a niche for sure.
Well, you have to watch QT intervals with that drug.
Well,
So says the FDA, eh?
so they do, but that's based on gepirone IR, the immediate release formulation, which is very different. And you might get we should be getting ECGs on people who get tricyclics too, but do we do it? We should be getting levels on people, but people just we're not using as high a doses, I guess, or things like that. But still, I don't, it's recommended. They didn't require that you get EKG testing throughout. I think it's probably wise to check it at the very beginning. We check it with a lot of our meds anyway, right in our clinic for QTC.
So as we're kind of wrapping up with some of these thoughts, anything else in the bag of tricks? Is there still a place in 2026 for yohimbine or for periactin or the stuff I was taught in
No.
100 years ago? That should all be left
Just throw
behind.
that out.
Because they don't work,
Because
because they're cumbersome, because we
no,
live
it
in a
worked,
capsule.
but they had adverse effects that were problematic. And you don't, I don't think you need to do that to people. I
That's it.
think we have better drugs now. Vilazodone is another drug that has lower sexual side effects because it has a 5-HT1A effect, as well as the serotonin reuptake inhibitor. And so, it's just not as strong. The studies that they did, basically, there were people who were taking the antidepressant and then stopped taking it while they were still potentially the comparator. And so it, and then this is what's crazy to me about these fake patients. Is they come in and they tell you they have all these symptoms, right? Or they have these problems. And then they start to tell you they're improving because they think that's what you want to hear. And then they stop taking it. And so when sexual functioning is happening, sexual dysfunction is happening, maybe depression would be getting better, but they're having sexual dysfunction and we're evaluating that. And then they stop taking it. Then they start saying, oh, yeah, no, I'm not having sexual dysfunction. So then you think that this SSRI comparator isn't, it has a lower rate of sexual dysfunction, but it's because they're not taking the drug. So it's some of these studies are problematic because of people wanting to get into the studies for various reasons.
But for our viewers and listeners who are sort of thinking, how can I elevate my game in psychopharmacology? When you look at a molecule, I guess any molecule, and you might want to be thinking about, is a prolactin sparing or not? What is its effect on serotonin 2A and also 5-HT1A, a
Yeah.
receptor that maybe we should be talking more about with our
You
training
definitely should.
and ourselves? Is that, those are three really important targets. So rather than just shrug and say, well, let's try something and see what happens, if patient identifies sexual dysfunction as a thing, those three elements should probably come to the forefront as a clinician is, say, looking at an atypical antipsychotic. Some are 5-HT1A partial agonists, not all,
Right?
but now
Not all.
you can up your game, folks, by just
Right.
thinking about, what are the receptor targets of the drug as you're making your informed decisions. Wow.
Yeah, and lumateperone, like I said, we studied. It doesn't show all of that. I guess it does have some of those effects,
Well,
but
5-HT2A.
2A. But I think it's that was clearly demonstrated that it had a positive effect on sexual dysfunction.
Boy, so what an opportunity. This has been great. What an opportunity to sort of really learn about psychopharmacology through sex. Who
Yes.
would have imagined that this is almost like a window into thinking about receptors and targets and symptoms and their interplay between underlying psychiatric conditions? Not just this is a thing to think about, but you've really taught us in this time. Anita, about why this is so important, not just because it matters to patients, but as prescribers and clinicians who want to think about the brain and what our medicines are doing, that this is really a microcosm in so many ways.
Yes, it
Wow.
is.
Any last thoughts before we wrap up?
Sex is important to almost everybody, and if you have good sex when you're young, you're still having good sex when you're old. So don't forget about old people who are having sex, and then our meds or their illnesses are contributing to that, to sexual dysfunction. So keep them in mind too.
I cannot improve upon those words. So with that, I'm going to close this out. And Anita, thank you again for such an informative, elevated, intellectually stimulating and eye-opening opportunity for us to really think about things that we may not have been thinking as much about as beforehand. So thank you once again for joining us today. Everybody out there, hope
Happy
you
to.
found this as informative and useful as I know I did. And thanks for joining us. I hope to see you again real soon on the next episode of Brain Trust, Conversations in Psychopharmacology. Till then, take care.
This podcast is presented by Psychiatric Times, the number one psychiatric publication in the U.S. Visit us at psychiatrictimes.com for the latest clinical news, expert perspectives, and CME opportunities. Thank you for listening.